problematic and life-threatening. Under the Dome is also King's take on the Peter Principle. A person is promoted to his level of incompetency, as seen through a political lens. Big Jim is a thinly disguised Dick Cheney, and the clueless, newly installed sheriff is a thinly disguised George W. Bush. One more character, a thinly disguised warmongering Donald Rumsfeld, would have rounded it out. As King joked on his website, there's no place like Dome, which is true. Under it is where the townsfolk live, calling it home, where they make their stand. The TV adaptation of Under the Dome. We are all in this together. Big Jim Rennie in the TV miniseries. King fans are used to seeing his books freely adapted for film and TV, with some directors taking a lot of artistic license. But fans were surprised when the television version of Under the Dome's storyline significantly diverged from the book, which prompted King to explain that he had no problem with it, taking to his website to explain himself. Many of the changes wrought by Brian K. Vaughan and his team of writers have been of necessity, and I approved of them wholeheartedly. Some have been occasioned by their plan to keep the dome in place over Chester's Mill for months instead of little more than a week, as is the case in the book. Other story modifications are slotting into place because the writers have completely reimagined the source of the dome. The changes are a wise move on Vaughn's part, since King's imagining is out of this world. In 2015, the third season of Under the Dome will air on ABC TV. Tune in and find out what life is like under the dome. 102. Blockade Billy, 2010. I love old-school baseball, and I also love the way people who've spent a lifetime in the game talk about the game. I tried to combine those things in a story of suspense. People have asked me for years when I was going to write a baseball story. Ask no more. This is it. Stephen King, in a press release from Cemetery Dance, Blockade Billy's original publisher. Blockade Billy is a short book, so short, in fact, that flinched of the appropriately haunting artwork by Alex McVeigh, the Scribner trade edition beefed it up by adding a short story, Morality, originally published in Esquire magazine July 2009. As with The Man in the Black Suit and The Green Mile, the first-person narrator is an old man who looks back to recount his story. This time, he's telling it to Stephen King himself. At the heart of this story is a mystery. Who exactly is William Blockade Billy Blakely? Recruited as a catcher, he may have been the greatest player the game has ever seen, according to the book jacket copy. But today, no one remembers his name. He was the first and only player to have his existence completely removed from the record books. As is often the case, people in a King story, in this case Blockade Billy, aren't what they seem. Are they ever? As David Ulan wrote in his review for the Los Angeles Times, of course, Blockade Billy being a Stephen King story, there are bound to be complications, and indeed, these eventually lead to the downfall of both the player and the team. It's not giving anything away to say that King gleefully telegraphs this from the start. We contended for a while, partly thanks to Blockade Billy, the aging coach who narrates the story tells us. But you know how that turned out. Well, at that point in the story, we don't. But we're surely about to find out. Eric Spanberg, in his review for the Christian Science Monitor, concluded, all in all, Blockade Billy merits a curtain call for the endlessly prolific and inventive King. His novella makes a perfect companion for scanning the summer box scores, and most impressive of all, even conjures a momentary twinge of empathy for that most scorned baseball species, the umpire. The Skeleton Crew at Cemetery Dance. Anyone who picks up the first edition of Blockade Billy, published by a specialty press, Cemetery Dance, might be pleasantly surprised. Though it's a specialty press, a small press with a small handful of full-time employees, their books' production values exceed those of bigger publishing houses. It's one of the endearing aspects of specialty publishing in the horror-slash-fantasy field, and it's possible only through the largesse of Stephen King, whose generosity to specialty presses has enabled many to keep their doors open, to publish short-run books for aficionados of fantasy, science fiction, and horror fiction. Blockade Billy's original hardback publication features artwork by Alex McVeigh. It was published in a run of 10,000 copies, a drop in the bucket compared to a print run by Scribner for their trade editions of King's books. The first edition of the Cemetery Dance hardback had a little bonus laid in, a baseball card of William Blakely, and for the signed limited edition, a baseball card of Stephen King wearing a period baseball uniform was laid in. Not surprisingly, King wears it well. Publisher Richard Chismar, who has published several King titles, is quick to praise the big man from Bangor, who makes it all possible. In an interview for The Baltimore Sun, Rich told Andrea K. Walker, "King is as smart as can be. He's very gracious. And the biggest compliment I can give him beyond that is that he still does his work for all the right reasons. He loves it. He's passionate about it. He is the last person in the world you could say it's all about the paycheck. He could have taken a book like this and made a whole lot more money from someone other than us. But that's not what he's about." Arkham House, the granddaddy of small presses in the horror field, is still alive and well, publishing under the auspices of the founder's grandchildren, though the publishing schedule is not as robust as it was back in the day. These days, if you want to talk about robust publishing schedules, look no further than Chismar's fine small press, which continues to delight and amaze with its high-quality hardbacks and limited editions published for a discerning audience that appreciates the craftsmanship of a well-made book containing a well-told tale. 103. Full Dark, No Stars, 2010.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
Opening line of The Shadow, a 1930s radio show featuring a crime fighter. In an afterword to Full Dark, No Stars, a novella collection, King states his writing philosophy. "I felt that the best fiction was both propulsive and assaultive. It gets in your face. Sometimes it shouts in your face. I want to provoke an emotional, even visceral reaction in my readers." Three of the four stories in this collection certainly qualify as propulsive and assaultive. They include 1922, Big Driver, and A Good Marriage. 1922 certainly justifies the lead position in this collection. It's an unremittingly dark and harrowing tale well told in first person from an old farmer's perspective. He plotted to kill his wife and dump her down a well. Sound familiar? Set in 1922, the story's protagonist, Wilfred James, foreshadows what will follow in the fourth story in this book when he says, "I believe that there is another man inside of every man, a stranger, a conniving man who does the dirty deeds." Big Driver recalls a 1978 cult film, I Spit on Your Grave, in which local yokels chase a young female rider through the woods. She is stalked and gang-raped by four men, who leave her for dead. Seeking and wreaking revenge, she systematically kills them off, one by one. The best story in the book is the last one, a harrowing study in psychological horror. A Good Marriage is a title deliberately tinged with irony and shows King at his best. Though the character in his story is imaginary, it's based on a real-world murderer, Dennis Rader, known as the BTK killer, now serving 10 consecutive life sentences for a total of 175 years, with no possibility of parole. In an online photo, Rader looks like the churchgoer and Cub Scouts leader that he was. He is also, however, a remorseless murderer whose principal method of executing his victims was strangulation. He is known to have killed one man, one young boy aged 9, one young girl aged 11, and 7 women. At his interrogation, he confessed that he was planning to kill again on October 2004 and had already begun stalking his next intended victim. In other words, Mr. Rader is a human monster. In a curious twist of fate, when Dennis Rader's daughter, Carrie Rawson, heard about the movie version of A Good Marriage, 2014, Screen Media, based on her father's secret life, she was distraught and wrote an open letter to Stephen King through the media. "My family is done. We are tired. We are not news. We are not a story to be exploited and profited on, to be twisted and retold to your liking whenever you want. Leave us, the families and the community, out of it. My dad is not a monster. That's elevating him. He's just a man who chose to do some of the most horrible things a person can do. Not a monster, a man. A man who took 10 precious lives and tried to destroy countless others. He's not worth the attention. My mom is the strongest and bravest woman I know. She doesn't need her life respun in a story or on the big screen. Her life is a true testament of all that is good and right in this world. My family has tried hard to fight the good fight, to stand on our faith and live out a peaceful life. So let us live that life, and please, leave us out of it. Out of the noise and chaos and the ugly and the awful." King responded, sending a copy of the text to the Wichita Eagle that ran Ms. Rawson's original letter. "I don't think Mr. Rader's daughter has to worry about her father getting a big head. There's nothing glamorous about the portrayal of Bob Anderson in A Good Marriage. He's depicted as a banal little man, and none of the murders are shown. As for making millions from the project, not going to happen. AGM is a very small, independently financed feature that is opening in less than 24 venues. How it does as a video-on-demand feature film, VOD, is hard to predict, but we don't expect huge returns. The story isn't really about the killer husband at all, but about a brave and determined woman. And while I understand Ms. Rawson's distress, the BTK crimes have already been chronicled in no less than 4 feature films, and there may be more in the future. I grant there is a morbid interest in such crimes and such criminals. There have been at least 100 films about Jack the Ripper, who claimed far fewer victims. But there's also a need to understand why they happen. That drive to understand is the basis of art, and that's what I strove for in A Good Marriage. I maintain that the theme of both the novella and the movie, how some men are able to keep secrets from even their closest loved ones, is valid and deserves exploration." In other words, King isn't an apologist for writing his propulsive and assaultive fiction. The irony is that Mr. Rader is now taking a page from King's playbook. In a 4-page handwritten letter to the Wichita Eagle, Dennis Rader, who has read King's story, is now collaborating with Dr. Catherine Ramsland on a book, which a portion of the proceeds is going to the victimized families. Citing King's visit to Wichita as a stop on his book tour for Revival, Dennis Rader ungrammatically wrote, "The main reason for the book idea is to help the VFs, Victims Fund, monetarily wise. Something I had hoped for years. To help them and in a way to pay my debt to them. I mean to burn no bridges and hope someday to open up. People like me need to be understood so the criminal professional field can better understand the criminal mind. That would be my way of helping debt to society." Mr. King, in his book Full Dark, No Stars, the last chapter, Good Marriage, the character, fiction, also kept his secret, until his wife found his main hidey hole. I'm sure other people have dark secrets that loved ones don't know about and live normal family lives. I figure with Mr. King coming to Wichita, once more BTK will be in the spotlight. I hold no bad feelings with the Wichita Police Department. 104, 11-22-63, 2011. Save Kennedy. Save his brother. Save Martin Luther King. Stop the race riots. Stop Vietnam, maybe. Get rid of one wretched waif, and you could save millions of lives. Al Templeton to Jake Amberson, whom he recruits to stop Lee Harvey Oswald from killing Kennedy in 11-22-63. Bang, bang, bang. Three shootings that irrevocably changed the course of history. John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert Kennedy, killed by assassins. History was changed forever, but what if you could go back in time to change history? Prevent JFK from getting shot, and perhaps prevent or shorten the Vietnam War and the assassinations of King and yet another Kennedy. That's the basic premise for King's 11-22-63, a date that baby boomers can't forget, just as World War II veterans can't forget a day that will live in infamy, and just as we, in more recent times, can't forget 9-11-01, the day the Twin Towers fell in New York City. King, a baby boomer, was 16 years old when he got the news that Kennedy had been assassinated. He was getting into a hearse. The driver, Mike, had the radio on. 10 years later, when King was teaching English at Hampton Academy, he had written 14 single-spaced pages of a novel about Kennedy's assassination, Split Track, but abandoned it. The research, he said in an interview published in a paperback edition of 11-22-63, was daunting for someone who was working full-time at another job. Also, I understood I wasn't ready. The scope was too big for me at the time. What King mostly needed was time to distance himself from the event, to get a fresh perspective, and look at those times and that dark day in particular with clarity. Genesis. In Marvel Spotlight, issue 14, January 27, 2007, King provided the details about the novel in An Open Letter from Stephen King. He wrote, "I'd like to tell a time travel story where this guy finds a diner that connects to 1958. You always go back to the same day. So one day he goes back and just stays. Leaves his 2007 life behind. His goal? To get up to November 22, 1963 and stop Lee Harvey Oswald. He does, and he's convinced he's just fixed the world. But when he goes back to 07... the world's a nuclear slag heap. Not good to fool with Father Time. So then he has to go back again and stop himself. Only he's taken on a fatal dose of radiation, so it's a race against time." King felt his new book, because it's historical fiction, had mainstream possibilities. "This might be a book," King mused, "where we really have a chance to get an audience who's not my ordinary audience. Instead of people who read horror stories, people who read The Help or People of the Book might like this book," he told Alexandra Alter of The Wall Street Journal. The book was a major departure for King, especially since it required a tremendous amount of research, which is unusual for him. He usually starts with a premise, sets up the characters, and starts writing the story, trusting his instincts to carry the day, and the story as well. But this book had to be historically accurate, which meant he had to have a researcher assist him. He recruited Russ Dorr, a longtime friend who helped on Under the Dome, among other books. King also sought the input of the renowned historian Doris Kearns Goodwin and her husband Dick Goodwin, a former advisor and speechwriter for Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who speculated that the worst-case scenario was that former Alabama Governor George Wallace would become president. Perish the thought. Told in split tracks, one track running through the time period from the late 50s to the early 60s, the other running through contemporary times, the lengthy 849-page novel features Jacob Jake Epping, who lives in Lisbon Falls, Maine. Through one of his students, who becomes a friend, he's introduced to Al Templeton, who who owns and operates Al's Diner. Al harbors an astonishing secret. He's got a portal to the past, a doorway that opens up at 11:58 a.m. on September 9th, 1958, no matter how many trips are taken in the past. It answers the question Al's patrons can't figure out. How can he sell his burgers so cheap? It's because he buys beef at 1958 prices, brings them back to the present, and passes on the savings to his customers. But everything's not Jake. Dying of lung cancer, Al lets Jake in on his big secret and enlists him in his lifelong quest to go back in time to prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963. As Al tells Jake, "You can change history, Jake. Do you understand that? John Kennedy can live." History is changed, but not the way Al and Jake had foreseen. He discovers the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Father Time, who is dead set in his ways, doesn't like to see his timeline manipulated. What binds this braided novel together is a love story that remains intact despite time's passage. It's Jake's love for Sadie Dunhill that motivates him to go back in the past to change history and save her from an untimely fate. Early on, when he first meets her, he's torn between accomplishing his mission or abandoning it for her so they can live out the remainder of their lives together. It recalls the classic setup posed by Harlan Ellison in the Star Trek television episode he wrote, The City on the Edge of Forever, in which Captain Kirk must choose between letting history run its course and letting the woman he loves die, or rescuing her, and in doing so, irrevocably altering the future, clearly not for the better. Errol Morris, in the New York Times book review, called King's novel a meditation on memory, love, loss, free will, and necessity. It all adds up to one of the best time travel stories since H.G. Wells. In Janet Maslin's review, also in the New York Times, she wrote, "The pages of 11-22-63 fly by, filled with immediacy, pathos, and suspense. It takes great brazenness to go anywhere near this subject matter, but it takes great skill to make this story even remotely credible. Mr. King makes it all look easy, which is surely his book's fanciest trick." Don Oldenburg in USA Today enthusiastically wrote, "It is not typical Stephen King. It is extraordinary Stephen King." Notably, Jeff Greenfield, Washington Post, reiterates in his review Echo's Leslie Fielder's prescient comment that his work suggests that if a time traveler found a portal to the 22nd century and looked for authors of today still being read tomorrow, Stephen King would be one of them. 11-22-63 is the work of a mature writer at the height of his powers. As Mark Lawson of the British newspaper The Guardian wrote, "In these books, the reader feels the benefit of 40 years of narrative craftsmanship and reflection on his nation's history. Going backwards proves to be another step forward for the most remarkable storyteller in modern American literature." Q&A, Russell Doerr, Stephen King's researcher. Interviewed by Stephanie Close. Library Journal, December 4th, 2013.
Library Journal. How did you start working with Stephen King?
Russell Doerr. 35 years ago, I was in practice in Maine, and Steve came in with food poisoning. He'd listed author as his occupation on the form, so I asked him what he wrote. He said he wrote a book called Carrie, and I asked him what it was about. He said it's about a young girl who sets things and people on fire. And I said, "Oh, that's nice. Have you written anything else?" And he said he had a book called Salem's Lot coming out the next week that was about vampires invading a small Maine town. We were both young, and we'd run into each other around town and got to be friendly. I was working on a master's degree and asked him to come talk to my class. Then he asked me to help him. He was working on a book about a virus that was going to kill off 98% of the world's population. Would I read it? I was taking three courses, and it was 1,500 pages long. I didn't have time. But I told him I'd sit down and help him craft the virus and figure out how it would morph over time. Then I started reading whole books. Back then, he'd hand me a typewritten manuscript. I'd read it and put in changes for the medical stuff. I can't even remember all the books. I didn't touch every book, but I did work on most of them. I've morphed from being a medical consultant to being his research associate. For Under the Dome, he approached me ahead of time with an idea for a story. A small main town that would be sealed off for months, and asked me to think of all the ramifications. Food sources, energy, medical issues. He'd send me 50 pages at a time as he wrote. I'd give notes, then he'd send the rewrites to me. And he'd have questions on the fly. How do you build a nuclear warhead? What's the most corrosive acid? With 112263, he had this idea about going back in time, so I started doing research 6 months before he started writing. I had a huge three-ring binder that was as big as the book. Since it was historical fiction, I had timelines for Lee Harvey Oswald's locations and so on. It was a lot of work, but also a lot of fun.
Library Journal. What research methods do you use?
Russell Dorr. A bunch of sources. I use reference books at the library. The internet is very good, but like in All the President's Men, I make sure I have three independent sources. Not everything is true out there. And I have people I can contact. In Under the Dome, there's a scene where a cruise missile is aimed at the dome. It's going to be released from a B-52. So I called a retired Air Force colonel who had flown B-52s to find out where they keep the planes, how long it would take to get one, that sort of thing.
Library Journal. What is the most difficult research question King has asked you?
He wanted to know where this fellow General Walker had lived in the Dallas area. He was the first person Oswald had tried to assassinate. I spent 3 or 4 days researching. I couldn't sleep at night. I just could not find him. It wasn't essential to the story. If I couldn't find the address, it would be okay, but I really wanted to get it. Luckily, my partner, who's in real estate, has access to websites with old tax records. I finally found the address on a tax receipt from 1963.
Library Journal. What's the most disgusting thing he's ever asked you to research?
The most disgusting thing was how to make methamphetamine. It's a side story in Under the Dome. There's a character who was cooking crystal meth. I told him I had a problem with it, but he said we weren't going to make it a cookbook. He just wanted to make sure we got the ingredients right, that kind of thing. I'm just not into drugs. That really turned me off. Also, I thought Pet Sematary was just a horrible story about child death. I told him he shouldn't publish it. He laughed when I said it, but that was a really tough story.
Library Journal. What can you tell us about Dr. Sleep? Note, his answer contains spoilers.
Russell Dorr. His books are sort of like a 7-layer dip. There's plenty there for the fanatic who likes his scary stuff and gore, but you also have a story about a struggling, recovering alcoholic. The main character, Danny Torrance, who was a little boy in The Shining, works in a hospice. There are these creatures, the tribe, who kill children who have shining powers. They capture the dying breath and store it in a sort of steam. They live for centuries by breathing the steam. One of the children they kill is sick with the measles, and it's the measles that ends up killing the tribe. It's pretty well known how the measles virus affects the body, but we had to figure out how it would affect these creature people and morph inside their bodies and how to make it plausible. He weaves this stuff into a tapestry that people will believe and care about.
Library Journal. You have such an intimate look at his upcoming releases. Do you have to sign non-disclosure agreements for the books you work on?
Russell Dorr. No, of course not. This is Maine, not New York City.
Library Journal. Is there anything you'd like people to know about Stephen King?
He's a very regular guy. We've been buddies for years. His wife called the day after his accident, In 1999, King was hit by a van while taking a walk and suffered extensive injuries to his legs and hips, and we spent 3 weeks together. He was a huge help to me when my wife was dying of cancer. He's a very nice guy.
105. The Dark Man, 2013. Randall Flagg came to me when I wrote a poem called The Dark Man when I was a junior or senior in college. It came to me out of nowhere, this guy in cowboy boots who moved around on the roads, mostly hitchhiking at night. Always wore jeans and a denim jacket. I wrote the poem in the college restaurant on the back of a placemat. But that guy never left my mind. Stephen King, The Dark Man, Book Jacket. If there's one dark figure whom King readers know well, it's the Dark Man, who goes by several nicknames. The Walkin' Dude, the Hard Case, the Ageless Stranger, the Man in Black. No matter what you call him, he's the ultimate badass who, as King noted, came to me out of nowhere. He made his first appearance in a 1969 poem published in the University of Maine at Orno's literary magazine, Hubris. He's also shown up significantly in The Stand, The Eyes of the Dragon, as the King's trusted advisor, and the Dark Tower story cycle. The poem, which appears in book form for the first time in the Cemetery Dance Edition, 2013, shows a side of King most people are unaware of. He studied and wrote poetry during college. But the Dark Man's omnipresence visually in this Cemetery Dance book is special, because Maine artist Glenn Chadbourne parsed every line of King's original poem to extract every possible image, resulting in a book in which the poem serves the art, with one illustration per page. Glenn followed it up with a phone book-sized portfolio crammed with even more art. The 88-page book is among my favorites of the ones Glenn has illustrated, because it's obvious that he poured his heart and soul into it. The color art for the dust jacket features a moonlit night with a dark man in the foreground, walking to a ramshackle house. So, who's Glenn Chadbourne? For starters, he's a lifelong Mainer.
I live in Damariscotta, which is an hour north of Portland.
It's one of those little picture postcard kind of towns, with lighthouses, the ocean, rocky coast, etc. He's also a full-time artist, best known for his connection to Stephen King through numerous Cemetery Dance projects, including two anthologies, The Secretary of Dreams and Full Dark, No Stars, in two volumes. He also provided the logo for the King's Haven Foundation and the PS Publishing edition of Carrie. His favorite assignment, though, was illustrating The Dark Man, which he described as an absolute dream gig. It's probably my favorite Stephen King gig to date, because they gave me carte blanche to go wild on it. I had this short, creepy poem to go by, and we figured 80 or so pages to play with. So I got to use every drop of imagination to build this eerie, nasty atmosphere that creeps along to a climax. I loved every second of dreaming up a real desolate feel. I kept thinking of Rust Belt towns on the fringes of things, and a sort of sultry, lonely, southern gothic thing at the same time. Hopefully I pulled off a decent job. If I did, it was channeled from the Dark Man himself. Glenn Chadbourne, an interview. George Bean. As someone who has lived in Maine his entire life, not yet, I can hear you say, do you feel a special affinity toward King's work because he's a Maine writer and because he writes horror/suspense fiction? Glenn Chadbourne. Well, I'd have to say yes to both reasons. Maine is a unique place with a unique atmosphere, especially once you get off the beaten picture postcard touristy track. Though if Steve had lived in Ohio and set his backdrops in Cleveland, I'd still love the stories equally as much. It's fun to live around here and read books that take place in fictitious settings while being surrounded by real towns that exist. There's a cool, creepy factor to that for those of us who live a stone's throw from Salem's Lot. I often tell PFA, people from away, who ask about Stephen's stories that he's put us on the map as the Transylvania of America. GB. What are some of your favorite King books or stories? Glenn Chadbourne. They all speak to me on some level, because you're inside the characters' heads and worlds, and you can relate more often than not to situations in the books. You feel for the characters. It goes back to the main thing for me. My old grandma could have been cast in either Dolores Claiborne or the great short story, The Reach. But I guess I'd have to say Salem's Lot, because it creeped the bejesus out of me and still holds up. I recently listened to it on my Kindle, not having read it in eons. I also just chewed through Revival, and that left me speechless with dread. It's a bleak book that jolted me and shows Steve has plenty of dark mojo left for the gut-wrenching stuff. I could go on and on, but as far as favorites, I think of them more along the lines of a yummy buffet featuring any amount of tasty dishes to munch on, each with its own special flavor. GB. What would be your dream Stephen King project? That is, what would you absolutely love to illustrate, if the opportunity came up? Glenn Chadbourne. The Mist. I love to draw creepy crawlers. GB. Have you ever met King? Glenn Chadbourne. In all the years I've been lucky enough to illustrate different things for him, I've yet to meet him. I know and deal with his personal assistant, Marcia DiFilippo, with different gigs when they arise, and she's a real sweetheart. I've received email kudos from him over the years, and that's always nice. And I go up to the office from time to time, but he's never been around on any visits I've made. GB. How much work have you done for Cemetery Dance? Glenn Chadbourne. Oodles. The CD staff are among my favorite people on the planet, and I owe them a lot. 106. Joyland, 2013. The major job is still to entertain people. Joyland really took off for me when the old guy who owns the place says, "Never forget, we sell fun." That's what we're supposed to do. Writers, filmmakers, all of us. That's why they let us stay in the playground. Stephen King, Interview, Parade Magazine, 2013. Sometimes the best thing about falling in love is falling out of love, because it means you can get on with your life, no matter how long it takes. Sometimes, though, even a lifetime isn't enough. In Joyland, a 61-year-old man looks back at a time when he was 21 and reflects on life's sweet and sour notes. The sweet, growing closer to a girl named Wendy Keegan, whom he loves, and the sour, growing apart from her when she no longer loves him. Joyland, as book reviewers have pointed out, is more of a coming-of-age story than it is a crime-slash-suspense novel, which no doubt surprised some readers who were expecting the latter. Published by Hard Case Crime, a line of hard-boiled crime fiction, Joyland's ad copy suggests that its crime-slash-suspense and supernatural elements overshadow the story's personal and poignant aspects, but that's not the case. If you can enjoy a simple story of a young man in love, you'll find much to like in this short novel. But if you're looking for spookier fare, you may be crestfallen. The mystery, wrote Darren Franich for Entertainment Weekly, isn't too mysterious. The ghost hardly appears. Not that much happens, really. That fall was the most beautiful of my life, Devin Jones recalls. And I was never so unhappy. I can say that, too. Devin's situation recalls King's relationship with a college girlfriend that also soured. As he told Winter in Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, I had lost my girlfriend of 4 years, and Sword in the Darkness seemed to be constantly, ceaselessly pawing over that relationship and trying to make some sense of it. And that doesn't make for good fiction. In Joyland, King perhaps went back for one last time to achieve closure. I'm in my 60s now, says Devin Jones. My hair is gray and I'm a prostate cancer survivor, but I still want to know why I wasn't good enough for Wendy Keegan. Unlike Stephen King, who met Tabitha Spruce in his senior year of college and wound up marrying her, a relationship that has stood the test of time. Devin, a lost boy turned old man, is forever haunted by Wendy, a long-lost love. I'm not sure anybody ever gets completely over their first love. And that still rankles, recalls Devin. The story's origin. In an interview with Terry Gross on NPR's Fresh Air, May 28, 2013, Stephen King explained that the story's origin began with an image of a wheelchair-bound boy flying a kite on a beach. It wanted to be a story, but it wasn't a story, he told her. But the story grew, as it often does with King, and centers on an amusement park called Joyland, based on a real park in New Hampshire. And on its fringes is a mother named Annie, whose son, Mike, suffers from muscular dystrophy. Wheelchair-bound, Mike's simple wish is to fly a kite on the beach near Joyland. In his debilitating situation, you take joy where you can find it. The Publisher. King chose to go, once again, to Hard Case Crime, because it brought back old memories of when he was a kid growing up in rural Maine. We lived way out in the country, he told Gross, and my mother would go shopping once a week to the Red and White or the A&P to pick up her groceries, and I would immediately beat feet to Robert's drugstore, where they had a couple of those wire spinner racks with the hard-boiled paperbacks that usually featured a girl with scanty clothing on the front. That was back in the 50s and 60s, and then the world moved on. The cheap paperbacks with the lurid covers became a part of book publishing history until Charles Ardai and Max Phillips revived their provocative, in-your-face cover art and hard-hitting prose for their line of books. Their website, Hard Case Crime, is dedicated to reviving the vigor and excitement, the suspense and thrills, the sheer entertainment of the golden age of paperback crime novels, determined detectives and dangerous women. Fortune hunters and vengeance seekers, ingenious criminals and men on the run. So Joyland doesn't quite fit in that mold, which is why I agree with Bill Sheehan, who wrote in the Washington Post that, like the Colorado Kid, Joyland depends on King's typically unerring sense of character for its deepest effects. King has created a moving, immensely appealing coming-of-age tale that encompasses restless ghosts, serial murder, psychic phenomena, and sexual initiation. And though there's joy in Joyland, there's none for wheelchair-bound Mike, who gets to fly the kite on the beach, but not in the way he imagined. 107. Doctor's Sleep, 2013. A return to balls to the wall, keeping the lights on horror. Stephen King on Doctor Sleep, from his official website. In Fear Itself, a collection of essays about Stephen King, Peter Straub wrote, Meeting Stevie, which concerns King's third novel, The Shining, 1977. It was obviously a masterpiece, probably the best supernatural novel in 100 years. He was now quite clearly one of the best writers of any kind in the United States. 36 years later, King wrote a sequel, his only one to date, to The Shining. King told The Guardian that it was about a cat in a hospice that knows when people are going to die. He would go into that patient's room and curl up next to them, and I thought, that's a good advertisement for death, for the emissary of death. I thought, I can make Dan the human equivalent of that cat and call him Dr. Sleep. There was the book. Titled Dr. Sleep, Danny Torrance is middle-aged and, like his father, he bounces around from job to job. He winds up working at a hospice in Fraser, a small town in New Hampshire. Also, like his father, Danny's a recovering alcoholic. It's time, he realizes, to get his life back on track. Haunted by the past and by the Overlook Hotel and its ghosts who still bedevil his thoughts, Danny once again relies on his old friend and mentor, Dick Halloran, to help him cope. Similarly, Danny's role at the hospice, aided by his psychic abilities, is to put people at ease and help them cross over when they realize the end is near. His unusual talent is then put to good use. Forever Young. Abra Stone, a young girl whose shining talent is greater than Danny's, makes contact telepathically with him. After psychically experiencing the murder of a young boy by a group called the True Knot, psychic vampires who feed on their victim's life energy called steam when they die, they are now aware of and hunger for her because their diminishing stock of steam stored in canisters is nearly depleted. Without it, they will eventually die. Rose the Hat, the leader of the True Knot, realizes that Abra's steam will replenish their diminished stock for many years to come, because she's a psychic gusher. Her steam, procured through her torture, means they will have plenty for years to come. The True Knot heads east in a caravan of RVs to capture and kill Abra Stone. Understandably, King was concerned about his constant reader's perception of the new book. Comparisons with The Shining are inevitable, as he told the BBC. You are faced with that comparison, and that has got to make you nervous, because there is a lot of water under the bridge. I'm a different man. What a lot of people are saying is, well, okay, I will probably read this book, but it cannot be as good as The Shining. But I am obviously an optimist, and I want them to say when they get done with it that it was as good. But what I really want them to say is that it is better than The Shining. In truth, the issue isn't whether one book is better than the other, because they are very different books. The Shining is a recognized classic, the work of King's most cited by college professors for its significance and teachability. It has stood the test of time for over four decades. Dr. Sleep is a newcomer, and though it has generally been reviewed well, a distinction between the two must be made, as a reviewer for The Telegraph pointed out. It's quite a different order from The Shining. There isn't the same claustrophobic elemental terror that has caused so many people over the years to develop a phobia of hotel lifts. The members of the True Knot are a memorably loathsome bunch, but having brought them vividly to life, King cannot make them as frightening as the more nebulous beings that terrorized Jack Torrance. The Shining was a yell of despair from the darkest of places. Dr. Sleep is a warm, entertaining novel by a man who is no longer the prisoner of his demons, but knows where to look when he needs to call on them. A seasoned writer who has spent a lifetime in New England, King's roots run deep. King, wrote Margaret Atwood in a review of the book for The New York Times, is right at the center of an American literary taproot that goes all the way down to the Puritans and their beliefs in witches, to Hawthorne, to Poe, to Melville, to Henry James of The Turn of the Screw, and then to later exemplars like Ray Bradbury. King draws on that taproot for Dr. Sleep, just as he did for The Shining and countless other tales. Though fans aren't likely to favor the former over the latter, the fact remains that Dr. Sleep is a worthy addition to King's literary canon. It's the perfect book on a cold night when the wind-driven rain patters against the window and the moon is bright and full. In other words, it's a well-told tale, but not in the same league as The Shining, an acknowledged masterpiece. Closure. For King and for Danny Torrance as well, Dr. Sleep finally brings much-needed and long-postponed closure. King has now said everything he wanted to say about Danny, who, by novel's end, celebrates 15 years of sobriety. Just as Danny turned to Dick Halloran for succor and received it, he in turn provides assistance to Abra Stone to make sure she doesn't follow his self-destructive path. In the last chapter, Danny has a heart-to-heart talk with her. She's not like her contemporaries. She has the power. And she has to learn how to handle her frustrations, her anger, and not give in to it. I'll try, she says. I'll try real hard. Danny hopes that will be enough. So, too, do we. Abra is 15, and she has miles to go before she sleeps. A lifetime ahead that, with sound choices, may be one of fulfilled dreams and not nightmares. As for the elderly people at the hospice where Danny works, the years of their lives are largely spent, and unlike her, they don't have miles to go before they sleep. They face the long sleep soon. But Danny, as Dr. Sleep, is there to ease their passage into the next world, in whatever form it takes. If indeed there is such a thing as an afterlife. Oscar the Cat. His name is Oscar, and he's a handsome little fellow with tortoiseshell markings and white fur. Adopted as a kitten, Oscar has no time to spend with healthy people. He prefers the company of the nearly departed, the elderly people who will soon pass on. At the Steer House Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Providence, Rhode Island, Oscar makes the rounds. In 50 documented cases, Oscar, according to a story in the Guardian newspaper, spends days pacing from room to room, rarely spending any time with patients except those with just hours to live. If kept outside the room of a dying patient, Oscar will scratch on the door trying to get in. Dr. Dosa and other staff are so confident in Oscar's accuracy that they will alert family members when the cat jumps onto a bed and stretches out beside its occupant. To date, there has been no scientific inquiry to investigate the phenomenon, though there is a lot of speculation. In any event, Oscar's presence presages the imminent end of a person's life and provides a measure of comfort to the dying by simply being there, especially when the elderly person's family is far away. He serves as their feline friend. Oscar is one of life's real-world mysteries. Dr. David Dosa has written a book about the facility's prescient cat, Making the Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat. Dosa's Q&A in the book explains Oscar's backstory. He explains that he was originally a skeptic, but soon became a convert. I became convinced of Oscar's abilities, though, when there were two patients on the floor dying simultaneously. All of the staff thought that one of the patients was closer to death, but Oscar remained attached to the other patient. At one point, a nurse's aide became concerned that Oscar's streak of predicting death would end and brought the angry cat to the bedside of the more seriously ill patient. Oscar looked at everyone like they were crazy and sprinted out of the room, returning to his vigil at the bedside of the first patient. Oscar's charge died a few hours later, but the other patient rallied for a couple more days. 4 hours before the second patient died, Oscar came to his bedside. 108. Mr. Mercedes, 2014. At a public talk on December 7, 2012, at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, Stephen King spoke about the genesis of Mr. Mercedes. He explained that when driving back from Florida to Maine, he stopped in South Carolina and checked into an inexpensive motel. There was, he said, nothing to do but watch TV. And so he turned on the tube and watched with fascination a news story about a woman who drove her car over job seekers who had lined up at a McDonald's restaurant where applications were being handed out. After attacking a woman in line whom she pasted with a couple of good ones, she got back into her car, threw it into reverse, and backed over two more people on the way out. And I thought to myself, I want to write about this. King can't recollect where the incident took place, but it may have been in Cleveland, Ohio, at a national hiring event hosted by McDonald's, during a nationwide push to hire 50,000 new workers. A witness named Joseph Shores explained, I was filling out my application when I saw two girls fighting. I don't know their names, but they were fighting over drama, hood stuff. as reported by Philip Caulfield in the New York Daily News, April 20, 2011. Caulfield added that the fight briefly breaks up and the person on the ground can be seen getting in the car while a shouting mob gathers outside the driver's open door. Suddenly, the car lurches forward with the door still open, and then, as the crowd screams in horror, speeds into reverse, sending four people flying. Mr. Mercedes begins with a similar scene of carnage. A stolen Mercedes sedan is driven into a crowd of job seekers, and in the confusion, the killer gets away. He's named Mr. Mercedes by the media, for obvious reasons, and remains at large. The only significant piece of evidence is a clown's mask, cleaned with bleach. In other words, there's no trace of the killer until he reappears, taunting his old nemesis, a retired police detective named Bill Hodges. Like others who feel useless in retirement after a very active life in the working world, Bill is profoundly depressed, and clinically so. He's contemplated suicide. But when Mr. Mercedes taunts him online, Bill finds a renewed purpose in life, to close the book on the killer once and for all by finding and capturing him. Of course, since Bill's retired, it's not his responsibility, but he figures that since it's an old case he had previously worked on, he's got a dog in the fight. The killer turns out to be, as they often are, a disaffected, angry young man who blames society for all his problems. Also, as these killers often turn out to be, he's aspirational. It's not enough to kill innocent victims waiting in line at the first annual city job fair. He wants to up the ante by killing hundreds of people, and plans to do so at a concert. But Bill, who put his service revolver away, is back on the case, albeit unofficially, and this hard-boiled detective novel gets underway. Bill teams up with Janie, the sister of Olivia Trelawney, whose Mercedes was stolen, and a computer-savvy 17-year-old boy who helps him with odd jobs around the house. A standalone novel, Mr. Mercedes is the first part of a trilogy. A mystery-slash-suspense novel, it won Best Novel in 2015 from the Mystery Writers of America, prompting George R.R. Martin to observe on his website. I was very pleased to see Stephen King take home the Best Novel Award for Mr. Mercedes. You want to talk about writings who have been shamefully overlooked by the Hugos, and by the Nebulas and the World Fantasy Award, too. Start with King. The world thinks of him as a master of horror, and he is. But horror is also sometimes known as dark fantasy, and King has written plenty of SF, science fiction, and even some high fantasy. Eyes of the Dragon, anyone? The Dark Tower, too. He's won the National Book Award, but he's never taken home a Rocket, Hugo Award, or a Rock, Nebula Award. So it goes, I guess. But at least now he has the head of Edgar Allan Poe, MWA Award. Bravo! Coming on the heels of Dr. Sleep, a horror-slash-supernatural novel, this one will likely throw some of his newer readers for a loop. But longtime readers know that King will never abandon the horror field, though he embraces other genres because that's just how he rocks and rolls. As Michael M. Smith of The Guardian points out, notwithstanding his reputation as the master of the dark side, King is always far more interested in how we get by in life, how we manage to care for one another and walk together toward the light, despite the darkness lurking within us all. Mr. Mercedes is, on the face of it, a stock book, as Stephanie Merritt wrote in a review of the book for The Guardian. The maverick detective who must operate outside the confines of the law, the killer with a personal vendetta and an unhealthy relationship with his mother, the band of misfits who cooperate to stop him before he can carry out his murderous plan. In less capable hands, Mr. Mercedes would be mere pulp fiction. But as Merritt observed, there's always more at work in King's fiction, which gives his books staying power. Stephen King may be the acknowledged grand master of horror fiction, but he has always known that the everyday demons hiding behind the screen doors of small-town streets can chime with our deepest terrors just as effectively as the evil creature in the sewer. Mental illness, addiction, poverty, childhood trauma, alienation. These are the real monsters that crouch beneath the surfaces of our lives, and they stalk the pages of most of his fiction in one form or another. Even in stories that appear to be concerned with more obviously supernatural forces of evil. 109. World Fantasy and World Horror Conventions, November 2014. I'm still a fan at heart, and one of the things which is real rough is not being able to go to a convention and go into the huckster's room and look around. Maybe pick up some copies of Weird Tales or other pulps without having people come up for autographs or talk about something they've written or you've written. They're hitting on you all the time, and you try to be polite, and you try to talk to them, but often you're just thinking to yourself, why can't I be like these other people and just be allowed to browse? You've become the browsee instead of the browser, kind of like a walking, talking book. Stephen King, interviewed by high school student Elaine Landa, 1986. Every year, professionals in the horror field meet at the World Fantasy Convention, worldfantasy.org. In 2014, the convention was held in Washington, D.C. From its website, it's an annual gathering, almost a reunion of professionals, collectors, and others interested in the field of light and dark fantasy art and literature. Attendance in 2014 was strictly capped at 850. The convention's roster of attendees boasted many of the big-name writers in the field, but not its biggest draw, Stephen King, whose success precludes his attendance. His presence is too great a distraction. Conventions for fans began informally in the 30s. In 1936, seven science fiction fans met at one of their houses in Philadelphia and formally dubbed it the first science fiction convention. Since then, conventions catering to fantasy, science fiction, and fantasy fans are held year-round, drawing massive crowds. Comic-Con International, San Diego, which started out as a comic book convention, is now a major media convention, drawing more than 130,000 with tickets selling out in a matter of minutes online. The New York Comic-Con, which uses a bigger convention center, draws 151,000. But for horror fans, the venues are smaller and more intimate by design. Stephen King was a guest of honor at the 5th World Fantasy Convention in 1979. The guest artist was Michael Whalen, who illustrated the Firestarter and Dark Tower novels. That convention was held in Providence, Rhode Island, from whence hailed H.P. Lovecraft, who once famously declared, "I am Providence." World Horror Convention, worldhorrorconvention.com. The other convention choice for horror fans is the World Horror Convention, which was started in 1991 as an alternative to the World Fantasy Convention. Unlike the WFC, WHC focuses entirely on the dark side. The World Horror Convention is an annual gathering of professionals in the horror industry. Publishers, authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, dealers, and, of course, horror fans. WHC serves as both an industry insider's networking event and a chance for fans of the genre to get together, meet some of the creative talents in the field, and generally spend a weekend celebrating all things scary. The 2015 convention was held in Atlanta, Georgia, though don't expect to see King, who has long since stopped attending them. 110. Revival, 2014. The inspiration was Arthur Machen's The Great God Pan, which is a terrifying story about the world that might exist beyond this one. Other influences were Lovecraft, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and my own religious upbringing. And I've been wanting to write about tent show healings for a long time. I wanted to write a balls-to-the-wall supernatural horror story. something I haven't done in a long time. I also wanted to use Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, but in a new fashion, if I could, stripping away Lovecraft's high-flown language. Stephen King, interview, goodreads.com. I live for rock and roll. Stephen King, live at Politics and Prose, George Washington University, November 12, 2014. The roots, the real roots to revival, go back to King's life in rural Maine, as King explained in a joint interview with Jerry Jenkins for Writer's Digest. While I'm not a big believer in the biblical apocalypse and end times, I was raised in a Christian home, went to church a lot, attended MYF, Methodist Youth Fellowship, lots of Bible drills, which every writer could use, Christian or not. Here are some of the most obvious parallels. King grew up in Durham. In Revival, Jamie Morton grows up in rural Maine, in Harlow, near Castle Rock. King grew up in the Methodist faith. As Stephen King's brother, David, explained to Spignesi in The Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia, when Stevie turned 12, we were in Durham by then, and we both joined the West Durham Methodist Church. So basically, we had a traditional Protestant upbringing. In Revival, the minister is also of that faith. By the time he was in high school, King became disenchanted with religion and walked away, after concluding that aspects of the Methodist faith simply made no sense. In Revival, it's the preacher who walks away,